afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, your comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis.
I'm Gary Lucy. Pat, I'm so excited today.
This is very fun today. We have across from...
Well, Matt Belknap's here.
I'm here.
That's it. It's very exciting to see Matt.
Matt Belknap.
That's not the exciting part.
It's been a week.
No, the exciting part is we have a guest in here today, folks, and very gracious to come in here on a Sunday morning, give up a little of his time.
I won't give it away, but I'll say not just rock and roll royalty, actual royalty.
Actual royalty. That's true. That's true.
Would you all address me as for the rest of this interview?
As you wish, sir.
I would love to.
This would kiss my jewelry. Maybe it would be better. How many times have I said that?
This would be so. Now, if anyone recognizes that voice, you can sit at home and be into the fact that you know who the guest is, even though we haven't said who it is yet. I want to run down real quickly. We have this gentleman to my right played at Live Aid.
Yeah.
He co-wrote a song called Animotion.
No, called Obsession.
Obsession. I'm an idiot. for the band Animotion. He's shared the screen with Clint Eastwood. He's been in movies like To Sir With Love and Under Siege. And he's been in television shows like Seinfeld, Roseanne, Frasier, MacGyver, Nip Tuck, JAG. And he has the distinction of being in the original WKRP in Cincinnati. And a regular in the new WKRP in Cincinnati. Ladies and gentlemen, a big rock solid welcome for Mr. Michael DeBar.
Sir, Lord Michael DeBar.
Lord Michael DeBar.
I'm exhausted from just listening to what I've done. I need to go back to bed. And
we didn't even mention music yet, but we will get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to the
music. That would be good.
Yeah.
So that was everything but the...
was everything but music. That's just a little taste of what this guy has
done. No, it's been an amazing journey. You know, I started off as an actor when I was a kid. I was very lucky to, at 15, 16, to be cast in a movie called To Sir With Love with Sidney Poitier, which is an amazing movie and changed my life, obviously, because I was introduced to many things at that time. I was introduced to the idea of what a movie star was by Sidney Poitier, who remains the most noble, charismatic man I ever met, and set
very
a template
classic
for work. You know, he was beautiful. He was so talented, and we watched him like a hawk. It was, you know, I went to drama school. They took out half of the class of our drama school and put it in the movie. So we already had a relationship, which was really good for the movie. And, of course, this is 1967.
Right.
So London in 1967, shall we say, was a little different from North Hollywood in 2012.
Swinging.
You know, it was swinging, and it was hashish, and it was velvet, and the streets were paved with velvet. and a lot of experimentation, a lot of drugs, a lot of...
Breaking boundaries. You were like the hoodlum East Ender kid. You were like the Bad News kid, right, with the shades on.
Yeah.
Was that close to your personality?
Absolutely not. I'm the sweetest man that ever lived, apart from Jesus and Buddha. No. I mean, it's called acting, you know.
Yeah.
I'd been to these boarding schools, so I was, you know, educated in a very sort of academic and traditional way. Because I was born into this family, you know, this aristocratic family, which, by the way, I mean, it means absolutely nothing to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it means a lot to my son, interestingly enough. But the whole lineage of the aristocracy to me is absurd.
Right.
You know, and it's elitist. And I was, you know, subjected to that sort of British class system, which sucks, you know.
And that was the spirit of the 60s, right, to rebel against that more in the...
Well, rock and roll has always been a working class gig, you know. And you come up, like sports or something, you come out of the ghetto with a guitar or basketball. Mm-hmm. And I came out with... eyeliner. but no, it, you know, the whole movie experience, I'd worked as a kid as an actor, but the acting was really important to me. People say to me, well, what do you like best, you know, acting or music? And I always say, I like to express myself in whatever form. I know that sounds corny and somewhat pretentious, but I get the same joy from hitting a scene, you know, nailing a scene really well. It's a rhythm. It's all about the rhythm. And you know, rock and roll is all about rhythm and energy. And to me, it's the same. The most exciting thing, of course, is standing in a hot, sweaty, packed club with a Les Paul around my neck and girls around my feet.
Yeah. With the acting, you don't get an immediate response from doing that like
film
you do
acting,
with music.
Well, go into a trance, you know, where if you're lucky, you know, it's like writing songs or any artistic endeavor. You find yourself in a frame of consciousness that transcends ego and transcends response. I'm not really there to get a response anymore. Right. I've learned that over the years. In the beginning, love me, love me, love me. But I don't feel that way anymore. I feel that if I feel good about what's happening, you know, the way that it manifests is you're not thinking. You're just doing what you do. And when the guy calls cut and somebody, maybe an applause or something, you know, that's an incredible feeling. But I don't do this for a reaction anymore. Yeah. I do it because it's all I can do.
Yeah.
And I love it so much, just expressing myself. You know, I'm 65 in January and I have a rock and roll record just come out.
Yeah.
You know, so that speaks volumes, I think, to my commitment to self-expression and art.
That's a good segue. Michael's here today to promote his new album. This is your first album in how long?
26 years.
What?
Yeah.
I was 12 or something.
Yeah, no. This is, I've been on TV killing people for the last quarter of the year.
Busy.
So, you know, but never have I ever strayed away from rock and roll. But, you know, when I did the Power Station Live Aid, that was such a high point for me in 85. And, you know, and I'd written Obsession and I was, you know, and it was one of those peak moments in your life with the private jet and these 22-year-old Duranis, you know, with bowls of Coke and half-naked, you know, pilots. In the private jet, you know, it was every fantasy one ever had, and I got that character Murdoch on MacGyver a week after the tour ended.
Wow.
You know, and everything went from there. Now that doesn't mean that I didn't go to Austin, Memphis, Nashville, you know, wherever I wanted to go, Paris, wherever I wanted to go, and listen to music,
yeah.
And get up with bands and sing with bands, and you know, and I mean, I've listened to Sonny Boy Williamson and John Lee Hooker my entire life every day.
Wow!
So it's never gone away. But I just relish the idea of changing, because I've found that if I do move from one thing to another, it informs the others. I don't become myopically rock and roll, myopically theatrical. Well, that's not true. But, you know, so I don't get stuck. And that's, I think, the great pressure of artists is they play, you know, themselves for the rest of their lives as actors.
And all those forms of art that you do, it's kind of it's different ways to get at that same feeling of transcendence, isn't
it? Like absolutely.
When it's going well.
Yeah, when it's going well. But it's going well if you say it's going well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's such a contrivance, but I've really spent the last few years of my life stripping away the artifice of what I do and trying not to posture with it and just be it. And I'm sure your listeners can understand this. You know, if you're learning how to play guitar, you're in a band, you know, you're being of service to the world. You know, you're entertaining people. The way that works, man, is it's a relationship between you and your audience. It's not you on some pedestal being worshipped and adored. It is when you're 19,
right?
But you know, not now. I'm 32. It's you know, you got to learn something along this crazy crooked path, you know, and it's a conversation. And I swear to God, this is true. At Live Aid, there were 100,000 people in the stadium, JFK, and you know, 2 billion people watching.
It's crazy.
And I realized in that moment, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's me and them, and we're one thing. Without them, I'm nothing. Without me, they probably wouldn't be there, or Madonna, or Keith, or Dylan, or whatever it was that day. And I realized something very important, that it's a relationship between me and the audience is what's important, not one or the other.
Exactly. How did the Power Station thing happen? I mean, Robert Palmer didn't want to tour. And they call you, and is it an immediate yes from you or something like that?
It was an immediate yes to audition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
You know, because here's the thing that happened. You know, I knew Palmer very well because in the early 70s, he was in a band called Vinegar Joe, and he was an R&B guy. This is before the sophisticate Robert Palmer,
right.
which he became, yeah. But he was always a very erudite man and a very bon vivant, you know, loved life. And we used to hang out, do lots of blow, and you know, and play rock and roll, and which is what you do. And
well, we don't, but you do. Well, until, we don't do that.
Yeah. Well, until you know, and nor do I anymore. I mean, until you suss out that's just you know, it's like the right earring or a good lyric, or so it's just something you feel you have to do,
right?
And enjoy some of it, not all of it.
We should say Michael is not high at this time. He's you've done a lot of work in the opposite direction. Rockers Against Drugs.
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Although you did admit your new cortisone addiction. You were telling us.
I'm addicted to cortisone because my body is just like, you know, so beaten up with the recklessness. but the power station story is an interesting one. What happened was Check It Past That with Steve Jones from the Pistols, Tony Sells from Tin Machine, Clem Burke and Nigel Harrison from Blondie with the rhythm section. It was an incredible band, super band, which was the kiss of death. But we'll get into that.
And who produced Check It Past? Who was the producer?
God. God said, and Michael shall singeth with the Sex Pistol. They will create a dreadful, you know, racket, which is what we did.
All those guys are still around. You guys could do a Checker Pass, too. Love it.
Oh, dude, you know, you're very sweet. It was an incredible band. I mean, you've got Clem Burke and you've got Steve Jones.
Great drummer. Great
you know, you've got an incredible band, you know, with yours truly flitting around in a cape. But but we opened for the Durantes in San Diego. Right, and they went, you know, they really liked it, and you know, and a year went by, and I was in Texas with Don Johnson, who remains a dear friend, and he was making a movie down there, and I went down there to hang out, and Ava Gardner was in this movie, and I adore Ava Gardner, and I wanted to meet her, and so I got a call down there in Marshall, Texas, which is in the middle of nowhere, from a promoter in New York, mm-hmm. saying that there's this band that has a tour book that needs a singer. And I said, obviously, what band? And they said, we can't tell you, Michael, but there's a first-class ticket for you waiting at the airport. Will you come to New York right away? And I said, yes. I'll come to New York right away.
Because the curiosity was killing you, probably.
Well, you know, nothing kills me except, you know, jealousy and envy and heroin. But, you know,
you don't want someone else to get that sweet gig. This is your gig to lose or get.
Yeah, I've always felt that way, though. I've never left an audition as an actor or anything without absolutely being convinced I got it. Now, I've been wrong 99% of the time. But nevertheless, you know, it's confidence that is catching. You know, you walk in that room and you own the room. You know, the room is yours, etc. So I go to New York. I go into this office. I'm met by the longest limousine I've ever seen, because Durante was like, they were massive at that. Yeah, they were the fucking Beatles at that point. Yes. You know, and they're 22 years old, and I was 14. So I go. I get in the car. I go to the office. I see a very nervous John Taylor and a very nervous Tony Thompson. Mm-hmm. And they have a tour booked, and Palmer said, I can't do it. And I suspect the reason that he didn't want to do it was because, you know, you're playing to 20,000 topless teenage girls.
Who wants to do that?
Now, who the hell wants to do that?
That's just a bore.
Well, he didn't at that point because he was a very, you know, he's in the Pinstripes, and he's a sophisticated, you know, R&B artist at that point. And listen, I had the deepest respect. But I do like topless girls, and especially 20,000 of them. And so, you know, but so
that's 40,000 boots. You know,
if you want to break it down, I could break it down further, but that's okay. So Andy's in London. So I get on the Concorde that night, the same night, and go to London, and with the album, which they got me and took his voice off.
So you're learning it on the flight.
On the Concorde, I'm going to get it on. Bang a gong, yeah, I can do that. Having known Mark Bolan for many years, sure, you know, I felt that I could do that. And I got to London and I waited in a studio for Andy Taylor to show up. And eventually he does, in a cloud of marijuana smoke and 12 bodyguards. He's only small. But what I'd done was I'd set the engineer to get that, you know, get it on track and my voice perfect. And as he walked in, I go, you know, well, you're dirty and sweet, clad in black, don't look bad. Well, oh, yeah, okay, let's go shopping. You know, and that was it.
Done.
And that was it. And I flew back to New York. And the next day, imagine this. I mean, just put it in your head, just what that was like.
I can't imagine.
I didn't sleep.
How am I going to imagine this?
I'm exhausted going to Trader Joe's.
Well, you know, the thing is, I've always been ready. This is very important for your listeners and anybody else that's in bands and actors or artists of any kind, or indeed, if you're a dentist. I mean, be ready. Just be ready for something beautiful and expect it.
Yeah.
And keep your curiosity and enthusiasm, you know, and life will turn out well. It did for me, and it has done for me, and it is today being with you guys.
And just so you know, Michael, this is This is actually an audition. We don't know if we're going to air this or not.
So far it's going over.
Yeah, we'll check the tapes at the end, and then we'll let you know.
Well, I just let me know, you know, how I did, man, and I'll be so grateful.
We'll call your people. Do you feel like doing a song now? Should we stop
sure.
that now?
Yeah, let's do it.
And then we'll come back and chat some more?
The new album's Carnaby Street. Oh. It was 20-some years in the making.
No, darling, of course not 20 years in the making. I made it in a week. Are you kidding me? I was 26 years in between albums. Don't confuse your listeners,
but you're writing all the time. I'm sure you just didn't stop writing behind the scenes.
There's a real story behind it. What song are you going to play?
Well, the one that I have queued up here is the title track.
Okay. Well, let me explain something.
Unless you want to play that one.
No. Okay. You play that one because it's a steaming rock and roll song, and I'm going to play you something else which is more interesting.
Excellent.
The story behind it is it's called Carnaby Street, which is this mythological street in London where all the clothes were being sold in swinging London. So it was a sort of a mecca of fashion. You know, everybody was there. Keith Moon was drunk out of his mind at noon with a bottle of brandy, and Pete Townsend would be buying a Union jacket, you know, and so on.
The Stamp Brothers were there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. God bless Chris. He just passed away.
Yes.
So that was the vibe. So I wanted, conceived of this record as a return, as an homage, as a memory, not a sentimentality, but as a re-evocation of music that I was at the crux of. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not something that I'm, you know, adopting in a retro way.
Right.
I was in the clubs watching Terry Reid. I was in the clubs listening to Georgie Fame. I was in the clubs watching the Yardbirds, Cream, Jimi fucking Hendrix. I went to school with Mitch Mitchell.
Wow.
He said, I'm playing with this black guy. You want to come? I go, oh, God. Okay, sure, man. Yeah, you know, whatever you're doing, I'll support. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, and I saw him, and he just, you know, it was the most miraculous thing I ever saw. It changed my life.
I witnessed a history.
I've seen a lot of history. Yeah. You know, I've been fortunate to be, have mentors. Deep Purple put me on their label. Zeppelin put me under their wing. The Pistols and Duran. It's pretty terrific lineage there, and I've learnt so much from all of those people.
Yeah.
But this album is dedicated to the swinging 60s. Why don't you rock it, Carnaby Street?
Excellent. Matt?
Here it is.
So now, just so I can get into it right now, listeners, this is on iTunes. You hear that song, how do you not go and just click buy immediately?
This
is so amazing. That's awesome.
Our guest, Michael DeBard, those opening scenes of the Austin Powers movie, that was a documentary for him. He was living that, dancing on Carnaby Street in his velvet pants.
Yeah. We were actually, it's always the way that people view it. You know, I think that Spinal Tap, while being this fantastic movie, actually killed rock and roll.
No kidding.
Because the archetype of the rock and roller is this monosyllabic fool, right? Mm-hmm. None of those guys, from Rod to Mick to Keith, are fools.
No. Smart guy.
But, it was a comedy, and it was one of the funniest things we've all seen. Mm. But I think it spawned an idea about rock and rollers being idiots. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can put your mind into the fact that in 1963, for these guys, these young men and women, adopted the blues from America, and they dressed like Oscar Wilde, and they played like John Lee Hooker. Mm-hmm. Now, that takes a certain sort of academic brilliance, a physical brilliance. I mean, if you're talking about intellectuals, Steve Jones is the most intellectual person I know. He could hardly read or write.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but he has an incredible innate instinct. So that has never been portrayed. You know, yeah. I mean, I think Miss Pamela achieved a great joyous literacy in her book, I'm with the band Confessions of a Groupie, my ex-wife, which is really required reading for anybody who loves music, because what it does is it shows a young girl who saw through the Spinal Tapness,
right,
and saw them as human beings. We've never been depicted as human beings.
Well, you know what's funny? When you talk about Spinal Tap, the band members in Spinal Tap, they obviously speak with an English accent. But yeah, when I watch that movie, I never think of Mick Jagger and these guys. For some reason, I just think of some lunkhead Sunset Strip band from the 80s that has an English accent. I really, because I do know that Mick Jagger and Pete Townsend and all these people are intellectual people and smart, and you don't have a career like they have if you're not.
Yeah, and the hair metal speaks for itself.
Yeah.
They lost their hair.
Right, exactly.
Just like Samson, with their power.
But the point is that people are very influenced.
Yeah.
And they, I don't know why I'm going on this tangent, but I think what I'm trying to say is that living the life of a musician, for one thing, mm-hmm. I looked this up and I wrote a blog on this for The Rap, which is an entertainment industry blog, about which profession dies early. Like, is it a dentist? Is it a doctor? Mm-hmm. Is it rock and roll musicians?
Yeah.
Have the shortest life. Now, why is that? That's because you're under such enormous pressure to produce. Not anymore, because now the corporate structure is gone. Thank God.
Yeah.
Right. Kids can make records and sell them out of the back of their car or the back of their laptop, you know. And it's a very much more healthier climate now than it was then. Then it was absolute servitude. I mean, Prince wrote slave on his face, and you know, and a number of other things, including my phone number. But which is why we sold a lot of records that year. But the thing is that it was servitude. It was a corporate criminal thing. I mean, shipping 300,000 albums and getting paid for 10 of them.
We don't have any money. To tie it in with your previous point about your ex-wife and I'm with the band and everything, you really do need to read that book. It's amazing. And you might come to it like, this groupie story, but like you want to get the salacious details. But what you take away from it is just the purity of her devotion to these artists. Is something that as music fans we all can relate to, and I'm a guy in my mid 40s, and I think why am I still interested in this music like that a teenager into, and it is because it is like there's that transcendence, there's that thing like these are the philosophers, these are the guys doing the work, and they're worthy of our attention and our adoration.
Well, they humanize
these feelings, the culture. They crystallize it for us.
Yeah, and that's right, and they simplify what we're all feeling and feed it back, and one thing feeds the other. The thing about loving music is exactly what Miss Pamela is all about. Is that she has great respect for great music. The other thing to remember is Robert especially was 18, 19, and he was a golden god.
Yeah. Robert Plant.
Now he came from the Midlands in England, working class background, no education. When they came to California and they met these girls that were, shall we say, somewhat more evolved in terms of the revolution that was occurring and fashion and drugs. And they introduced these young men and women, primarily young men then, to a different life, to a life of openness and love and turquoise bracelets. and if you look at those guys, when they first arrived on these magnificent shores where I've lived over half my life and love, when they went back to England, they're dressed like cowgirls. So there was an enormous cultural shift. And I guess the point I'm trying to amusingly make is these girls had a lot more effect on the intellect and the feelings and emotions of these young, brilliant men.
It was because, the reciprocation you were talking about between audience
absolutely
and...
Absolutely right.
Because surfacely, people would just say, oh, sex. But it's not that.
Yeah, well,
it's more
and
than
they're
that.
Right. You know, I mean, sex always comes first. You know, but then hopefully if you hang
around. When I'm involved.
Yeah, if you hang around, you maybe get inside somebody in different ways. You
right.
You dig, you know, and so it becomes an emotional attachment as well as a physical one.
And you and Miss Pamela were married for how long? Long time.
We were together for 14 years and married for 7. I am now in love with a beautiful woman, Britta. We've been together for 4 years, and I'm tremendously happy within the structure of that monogamous relationship.
Nice.
Excellent.
Lovely.
So now, behind you is what I call a guitar. Now, I don't know what you call it, Michael, but to me that's a guitar.
I call it Lucille.
Beautiful okay. Martin acoustic.
B.B. DeBarn.
So,
it's a song I wrote in the 80s. Cannot sleep, I am a possession. I'm open at your feet, and there's no balance, no equality. Be still, I will not accept defeat. I will have you, yes, I'll have you. I will find a way. I'm gonna have you, baby, like a butterfly. Wild butterfly, I will collect you and capture you. You are an obsession. You're my obsession. Who do you want me to be to make it sleep with me? You are an obsession. An obsession. Who do you want me to be to make it sleep with me? You know I feed you and I drink you. By night, and I need you by sun and candlelight. You protest, you wanna leave, stay. There's no alternative. Face appears again. I see the beauty there, I see danger. Stranger, beware of circumstance. And your naked dream, your affection is not what it seems. You are an obsession, you're my obsession. Who do you want me to be to make sleep with me? You are an obsession, you're my obsession. Who do you want me to be to make you sleep with me?
Unbelievable.
Now, Michael, when you and Holly Knight write the song, is it written in this way? And then because that's much different from the way the Animotion version is.
Yeah. So, well, I wrote it about heroin.
Okay.
Really?
It's about drugs. I in 81, I got off drugs, and the word obsession was totally everywhere I went, and I was obsessed and am obsessed to this day. It's a different word I use now, but very myopic about things. You know, I'll do it to the hilt, whatever it is. So I wrote the lyric really about that. And then when Holly and I sat down to write it, she's a really amazing musician and an extraordinary composer. And because it was the 80s and I knew I couldn't write about heroin for a pop audience.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, and God bless Lou Reed, you know, and others, you know, did. But I then incorporated into the lyric the fact that he's obsessed with a girl, know, and how can he get her? How can he you know?
Your version though that chugging drive, and it looks like it's a two chord song, right? And it's as someone who's who's had his struggles with substances or whatever, it really captures that sort of like driving. It's almost like a bolero or something almost, where it's just like a relentless cycle of chugging. Like you think you're going to get it, but then you've got to go back.
Well, if you listen to Heroes,
yeah,
it's the same feel. Or you know, by David Bowie, the greatest artist ever, you know, arguably. You know, it has a propulsion to it. So you're forced to listen to it.
Yeah.
It's other songs that exist in that manner. But what I've discovered is over the years is the less I say and play, the more effective it is. Mm. If I get lost in C diminished and ninths and all of that, I mean, you know, that's for progressive artists. Yeah. I am a degressive or whatever. You know, I mean,
not a math
you
one.
Know, I mean, it's just and that song requires the way I play it is not the way most people play it. Right. But I wrote it. So I can play it any fucking way I want. So,
dare I say it's sexier than the hit version.
That
synth pop.
That was pretty sexless, but that's okay. Yeah. I think they did a fantastic job, and I am very grateful to them, as is my son.
Going to the mailbox, that's sexy. Getting them envelopes.
That's right.
My account is extremely thrilled with that emotion to this day, because it's in some movie or TV show every, you know, all the time. But that's my particular version. I hope you enjoyed it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you so much
for fun to play, yeah.
Nice. Do you mind if we just give people a little taste of some of your past work with Detective and with Checkered Past? We're gonna play Got Enough Love, a little of that, a little of Warm Love, and then a little of Checkered Past, How Much Is Too Much.
Oh, great.
We'll get a little middly.
Let's hear a little bit of this.
It was a happy ending. The beginning, it was rough. You didn't want to believe that my love was enough. Such a coach, just a little girl. Afraid to dance to clothes. You always seem to disappear when the music got too slow. Got enough love for the two of us. I got enough love.
So, the Detective albums were on Swan Song, which was Zeppelin's label.
Yep.
And the drumming on this very sounds very much like a John Bonham groove to me. I like that a lot.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah. Wonder how that worked out.
That's 1975.
77.
Yeah.
And you haven't lost anything on your voice. You're like you take care of the instrument.
I did. Yeah. It got better. I mean, I just you know. In those days, I was extremely strung out on anything that was available. Which in some kind of mad way taught me how to sing, really. I mean, I've learned a lot about what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
But this album, you know, my voice, you know, we recorded the Viper Room show last week, and it's fantastic. I mean, I feel so blessed, you know. It's so difficult to put into words. I think I enjoy it so much.
It comes across. The gratitude and the enjoyment.
Let's jump into Checkered Past. Let's listen. This is what I deem a super group because you have Steve Jones from the Pistols, some guys from Blondie, and this is pretty great. This is How Much Is Too Much, Checkered Past. So that goes back to 1984. And again, we didn't discuss this with Michael, but I'm going to tell you that is on iTunes. And you go and you take your $9.99 and you buy this album. This is a great album from 1984. This is fantastic. I love it.
Thank you so much.
So great.
It's so interesting because I haven't heard it since 1984.
But you remember it. You still remember it. So.
I do. But often, you know, I listen to stuff and I go, what? You know, where was I? What was I wearing?
On the cover, you're not where you're wearing.
Not wearing much.
Just pants on the cover of the album.
Well, that's welcome to my career.
You kick back. You got the blonde hair.
It was a great band, man. I mean, you know, and I love the album, but live that band was really rocking.
All right.
And when we, you know, because of Steve, we attracted this punk audience. So we got together in New York, I remember, and we were a cover band. And we, it was that same band. Frank Infante was playing guitar mm-hmm. too, you know, from Blondie. But we opened with Vacation by the Go-Go's.
Nice.
So there's 1,000 punks in a club that holds 30.
And they're like, what
30.
The fuck is this?
And there's Steve, you know, dressed as Elvis. And you know, and yours truly, because I wore this cape in those days. It was my Nosferatu period. And the band was drunk and stoned, and we stumbled on there and played, and it was sounded so fantastic that we did. That was our whole set. We're just doing covers,
doing fun
and
covers.
Which was great because it freed you from doing what you've known for, and then you could reinterpret. Like we did "Church of the Poison Mind" by Boy George.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Cool. Unbelievable cool. songs he wrote.
Yeah,
just
oh, yeah.
shockingly talented, really. And Steve really loved that whole pop thing, uh-huh. but his way.
Yeah,
yes. You know, it's like when that famous thing about Glenn Matlock going with "God Save the Queen," the riff, and then Steve going, "Oh yeah," and then you hear Steve play it, and it's a different thing. I mean, he is and remains the yeah. greatest guitar player I ever worked with, Steve Jones, no question.
It's so funny that you say what kind of music Steve Jones likes, but like you said, the audience that is a Steve Jones fan at that time probably hated that stuff yeah. and probably had no idea that
well,
he loved it.
But that was the beauty of yeah. of punk, because like he's often said, you know, if I say it's fucking punk, it's fucking punk. You know, I mean, fuck off. You know, I mean, you, what's your idea? What is, you know, yeah. is it about smashing convention and starting yeah. afresh. If he wants to say Queen was my favorite band, you know, that's his right as a human being. And certainly to get characterized into one group is stupid.
Yeah.
You know, embrace everything and be curious about everything. And, you know, they say contempt prior to investigation. You know, it's a big mistake.
Yeah.
Big mistake. And every night
we... How do you know you won't like it if you don't
try? Exactly. And we proved that, you know, every night. I mean, we do these covers and, you know, a lot of Lou Reed, a lot of Iggy too.
Speaking of punk, you played the punk rock god on WKRP, lead singer of the Scum of the Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an awesome turn. You kind of bridge those two worlds between, like, you know, classic rock and punk and...
Yeah, and, this record does too. It's yeah. like there's songs on there that are very influenced by eighth note, you know,
right.
Punk rock, and I love the Pistols absolutely. You know, imagine, you know, I've been at it since '72, glam rock. Then I was yeah. in Detective, like big, powerful rock and roll band. Then I went up to San Francisco in '77. To see the Sex Pistols.
Sure, last show.
Changed my life.
Yeah. Well,
because it was an energy that we'd become tired. I'd become. Badum, badum. So fucking sick of it.
Wait, that's my whole iTunes library, what you just did there.
But then, it was, you know, you're like Eddie Cochran or something.
Yeah,
I thought,
yeah.
Oh, my God. This is and I wanted to, you know, I've always liked swinging music that really swings, you know, and that hard rock and roll is so potent and so powerful because of the enormous gaps that you have in the music and the holes that you can just sit on, you know, but if you pardon the expression. And you know, and that the liveliness and the commitment of Lydon, you know, blew my mind. And that was when I took a turn and the Detective, you know, fell apart.
What is Lydon like backstage? Does he spit on you? What does he say? Does he shake your hand?
You know, I've only met him a couple of times. I have the deepest respect for mm-hmm. him as a lyricist and as a chronicler of his time. And even so now, you know, he's really absolutely one of those extraordinary British eccentrics that mm-hmm. have yes. brought so much to the culture. You know, again, an uneducated man, I would imagine, but my God, he's as smart as it gets. And, you know, lyrically, the Sex Pistols were inconceivably good. And I remember when it came out and people were decrying the fact that they couldn't play. And in retrospect, what a load of shite that is. You know, what is playing? What is it? Is it notes? Is it right. It's energy.
It's feeling.
It's
yeah.
a feel. It's yeah. a soulful thing.
You I know, mean, obviously, it's not Steve Howe from Yes, but well, it's still its own thing.
Well, you know, Jones has the greatest description of progressive rock. He describes it like this. Well, it's like twiddly bits with stops and starts all over the place.
which is weird because
which I think is the most genius review of any form of music. There is one other review that is equally magnificent. Is when when Andy Summers put out a solo album,
yeah.
and there was a one-line review from, I think, a New York cynic. Did I say cynic? And it was, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that sting.
So, and you know, when the guy typed that, he was like, very yes. proud of himself.
Oh, fuck him. Yeah. I mean, I've been victimized by those bastards. I mean, when I took over from Palmer, who... You know, he's obviously a critic's darling, yeah. and it said it would be like replacing Elvis with Fabian.
Oh, come on.
Are you kidding me? They killed me. How could you, it's like replacing, it's like, okay, here's the new Jesus.
Right.
That's and he's going to, you know, die for your sins, and he's going to make videos with chicks. You know, I mean, you know, it's like very difficult to, but I could give a shit.
They make nothing.
Well, I've learned an awful lot about you can't rely on what other people think about you.
Not at all.
Because if you do, you know, you're damned if you do, you know, and you're damned, you know, you just got to be, you just enjoy what you're doing and maybe others will if you're lucky.
Well, that's what's kind of fun now with the internet and with iTunes, with Amazon, where the fans go on and they'll write the reviews and they'll tell you, that they love it.
That's what counts. I pay attention. You know, I have a lot of followers on the internet, mm-hmm. you know, and you, please, you guys, you know, Twitter me, Instagram, you know, Facebook me, whatever it is, you know, because I really, really, really love and respect you all out there. And I want to hear everything you have to say. I really do. I communicate. I don't call them fans. They're not fans. They're friends, and they've been so loyal to me over the years. I can't even begin to describe. It brings tears to my eyes just to think about it. Without them, I wouldn't have lasted, you know. And so I really encourage you to get in touch with me. And I listen to those people. I don't listen to people that are paid to criticize.
Right.
Because the thing is that journalism is about hatred and humiliation and negativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the paparazzi, like the tabloids, lies. Absolute concoctions of the truth, and I despise that culture. I despise the reality show phenomenon of humiliating people, of seeing these girls ripping each other's hair extensions out, of Honey yeah. Boo Boo puking on it. I mean, it's all a load of bollocks, and it's life, and I appreciate and love life in all its forms. What I don't appreciate is specifying the hatred and competition and humiliation that exists in our culture and putting it on television and claiming it's entertainment. It's not entertainment. It's voyeurism. Yep. It's negativity. And it's got nothing to do with what I'm about.
And it's certainly not art either. And I feel sad for the people that watch that show, those shows, and get so hooked. There's so much.
Well, it's a substitute for their own.
Right.
You know,
like
all entertainment to a degree. I mean, I remember when I did Roseanne's show And I loved Roseanne. Roseanne is a punk rock star,
as far as
I'm concerned. And she gave great validity to an authenticity to the blue-collar family, if you recall. I mean, before her, there was not any entertainment that was based on a blue-collar home.
No.
And that meant a lot to me, and I loved her. She was so incredibly what we're discussing. And now, of course, she's a political activist now. And you can easily dismiss her. Go ahead. But what she's saying is what, you know, a lot of scientists and academics are talking about, which is the collapse of the culture. Now, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we need to sweep it clean and start again, you know.
Yeah, from the middle out, you know, the middle class.
From the middle out, yeah, exactly correct. That's right.
Just because we jumped into acting with talking about the Roseanne show, how did you get to be the villain? Why are you the villain so many times? You seem so nice.
Mm.
The most recurring villain on MacGyver.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Murdoch.
Yeah. Well,
his nemesis.
I think that, again, it's archetypical. You know, I'm English. I have high cheekbones. And, you know, and the imagination of, shall we say, the major networks, it does not really extend to anything particularly creative. You know, I mean, it does now. It's amazing shows on television. Yeah. In the 80s, you know, of course. I mean, you know, Jeremy Irons, Alan Rickman, big movie stars playing bad guys. You know, I'll tell you how I got the gig. We did the soundtrack for Commando, you know, Power Station, with the Schwarzenegger movie. And
that song was We Fight for Love.
That's right. And which I wrote with Andy. And we, you know, I had this white Rolls Royce, and they asked me to come in to audition. So I had my role, and I had a driver, and I drove onto the set at Paramount, and this is particularly impressive, I think. And I'm driving past the MacGyver offices, and all the producers are outside smoking. And they see me pull up in all the black gear.
Yeah.
And you're holding a white cat.
A white cat. No, I had a white tiger. And Siegfried and Roy were in the front seat.
Anyway.
Blowing each other. And I came, the producers took one look at me. I got the gig in the fucking parking lot. I mean, you know, it was just so impressive with cigarettes and fall out of the roller. Oh, yeah, that's our guy. Put a gun in his hand. Yeah.
Awesome.
You gotta get in a Bond film. I gotta see you opposite this Daniel Craig.
I love Daniel Craig, and I love Javier Bardem in Skyfall. Skyfall is
phenomenal,
it's fantastic. It's the best opening sequence I've ever seen in any movie.
It's pretty great.
And I'm a huge Jason Bourne fan, but that was a fantastic opening to that movie.
Daniel,
so getting the gig, that was the next 6 years of my life,
right?
You know, and intermittently, to answer your question, once you play it once and it's been effective and I got such mail from fans, then the other networks go, okay, well, he can kill on O'Hara or whatever, like these obscure TV shows that I did, J.J. Starbuck, and shows that you never even heard of, and I'd go to Vancouver, just clean up, and come back, kill people, then come back, buy a house.
And your Pink Cadillac. Eastwood grabs you, puts a gun to your head.
That was heavy, because you know,
it's a scene with you, Clint Eastwood, and Bernadette Peters.
Yeah,
that's insane.
Doesn't get better than that.
No,
but that was funny, because I went in. And, I'm playing an Aryan Brotherhood biker. So I went in the audition, and he wasn't there. It was like a bunch of cameras and like official-looking executives looking at me. So I talked like this, and I was just so fucking mean and cruel. I just sounded like a horrible thing. And the camera's right here on my face. A stubble of my hair's in a ponytail, God forbid. And I got the gig. So I arrive in Reno in the mountains in Nevada, and Clint's there in this fucking huge trailer filled with Arnold Schwarzenegger's gym gear, because that's what he does, Clint. He's like an incredible workout dude.
And did Clint direct that movie also?
No, it was my buddy Van Horn.
Okay.
His second unit director.
Okay.
He let him do it. But, I'm 5'9". Clint Eastwood is 8 feet tall, as was my Aryan Brotherhood gang.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm the last one to arrive. So I come in and I'm literally looking up at them all. And I'm the boss.
Yeah.
So I said, and I go up to Clint and I go, go ahead, make my career. And he loved me. And that night we go into the trailer and he shows me a Thelonious Monk documentary, because he's a music fanatic.
Big jazz
crazy
guy.
Jazz unbelievable guy. Jazz guy. And I love Monk, Yeah. I mean, just because he was just, mad.
Yeah.
And brilliant, madly brilliant. So punk rock. Yeah. Absolutely correct. And he would dance and they would go hit one note and go.
Yeah.
Just brilliant. Like Dada, And we watched it in silence, me and him watched it because he knew I was music, blah, blah, blah. So I'm watching with me. And there's a Warner Brothers executive in the back. And at the end of the movie, Clint had bought it to put out on Warner Brothers to, popularize Thelonious Monk. He's that generous. And they had the Warner Brothers logo on the end of the movie. And he turns around to the executive and he goes, get rid of the fucking shield. Which was so heavy.
Chilling.
And I went, oh my God, what the fuck? Clint Eastwood rocks, because he was that aware of Kobe. He's made $2 billion for Warner Brothers.
Sure.
He can do whatever he wants.
Yep.
And he's Clint Eastwood, for Christ's sake. Let's forget about the Obama chair. It's not, blip in the history of an incredible, talented, brilliant man.
Wow. Now, between the acting and the music, they must be hounding you to get on Broadway all the time.
I would love to do a Broadway thing, but it's terribly hard work.
You're
doing 8 shows a week, I did a lot of theater as a kid, it would be great. I'm really working on a one-man kind of thing. I loathe even saying it because it sounds so pretentious, but one has had a rather charmed and interesting.
You got to share these stories.
Yeah. And
can I suggest a podcast? You should do that.
I mean, it's something that I think would really help, because the thing is that I had been redeemed You know, I've been through a lot of stuff, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of, like we all have. But and a lot of my contemporaries, you know, as I say, I'm 65 in January. A lot of my contemporaries do not exist. Or if they do, they're in a befuddled state. And I've never felt more creative. And I think that's an important message because guys of my generation, you know, today, the musicians anyway, you know, look at the Stones. You know, the Stones are more revered today than they were yesterday. And that's because I think of the longevity and the discipline that they and creativity. Because people say their music stopped in the 80s. It's bullshit.
No, not at all.
They're the Stones. It's like criticizing Father fucking Christmas.
Right.
It's beyond critique. Come on, wake up. Mick and Keith, give me a big break. I mean, you know, and I feel that I feel part of that in terms of that I'm here. And I, you know, and 80% of our audience, the Michael DeBar Band, which you can get on Facebook, you guys, if you want a Michael DeBar Band, or Twitter, whatever, you know, are young people. Young people who have not, who love the Faces, who love Humble Pie, which is what my music is like. The Rolling Stones, that blues-driven, bluesy rock and roll arena band, 70s, big endings. Their fucking endings were longer than most of these kids' albums.
Michael, do you have an opinion on what do you think? Should Led Zeppelin tour? Should they?
Definitely not.
You don't think they should?
Do
you think they lose legendary status if they go on their
own? I think that would be pushing it, losing legendary status.
That's
I think it would make a dent in that legacy.
Okay.
And, you know, here's the thing, Robert. You know, he lives in Austin now. He said to me recently that it's very difficult to sing about squeezing lemon juice down his leg at 60 fucking four.
Well, so, he's not wrong.
And for me, it would be akin to Anthony Hopkins playing Romeo. It's just wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, because that music is music of youth.
Yeah.
That voice was an incantation from Valhalla, and he doesn't dig that anymore.
Yeah.
He loves roots Americana. He always has.
Yeah.
Elvis is, you know, Raoul Donner.
Yeah, his last album, Band of Joy, is excellent.
Well,
I saw
both of these last two. Obviously, I see everything he does because he stays so in the moment with his music. And, you know, he's with Patty Griffin, and they make incredible music together. And I think, to answer your question in all seriousness, it isn't Led Zeppelin. John Bonham isn't there.
And no
matter who you replace, you know, The Who, it's the same thing. I did see The Who. The last time I saw The Who was the night after, God bless him, you know.
Entwistle passed.
Entwistle passed in the classic rock and roll way. You see, you know, John Lennon, he, in one of his last interviews, said that he'd rather be Gloria Swanson and live in his 90s than be Sid Vicious.
Oh, boy.
And you know, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Not because you want to stay alive, but because you want to be of service to the world.
Yeah.
I'm not in the position today of being, of taking anything. I'm a solutionist. I want to be part of the fucking solution. I don't want to be part of the problem.
Even Neil Young has backed off on Burning Out, fading away.
Well, you know, I hope I die before I get old.
I don't think so. No, let's not.
No, last time I saw Pete, he was selling his book in New York. You know, and what is he? He's 120 years old. He's a little younger than I am. And you know, so I mean, it's all bollocks. I mean, even Jagger, you know, said I'm not going to be singing Brown Sugar at 40. Well, try 70.
Try 70. you talk about the trials and tribulations you went through, and I think a lot of it is like the redemptive power of music. I just saw this amazing documentary called Lost Angels, Skid Row Is My Home, about people living on Skid Row. This woman, God bless her, riddled with lesions all over her body, just like all these bumps and tumors, lost a breast to cancer, can barely see, and her spirit. And then, like, the movie ends with her singing Jesus Loves Me. And she's just all about gratitude, us all about, doesn't talk about, you know, why is this happening to me, why these tests. It's just amazing. And, you know, she was actually there at the screening I saw, and she like sang a little something, and it's just like, and it's like you like have a choice. You can wallow or you can count your blessings.
Well, take this. Yeah. What I've discovered in terms of what you're saying, which is very beautiful, is acceptance of what is happening.
Don't worry about
is
what somebody
the key.
Else. Yeah.
Well, it's just accepting it. I mean, and it sounds very whimsical, but you lose a leg, you know, you've got to accept it. I'm a great believer in the philosophies of Eckhart Tolle, Krishnamurti, and other mystics who say that pain is the resistance of what is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You are going to suffer if you don't accept what's happening.
Yes.
Because what's happening is what's fucking happening. And if you say, God damn it, I want another leg, it's not going to help. Now, that's very easy and glib of me to say.
Yeah.
But if you can apply that to your life where you accept what is, that is, the train is late.
Mm-hmm.
The girl leaves. The man leaves. The job is lost. Now, all of these things happen to us all day, every day. Life is a challenge and a struggle. If you don't learn soon to accept what's happening to you, it will be painful.
Yes.
And I've always been of that. You know, it's like I've auditioned for roles that if I'd gotten, would have been transcendent in terms of my rise in the entertainment industry. And not getting them seemed to be the end of the world.
Right. Yeah, we've been there.
The next day, I meet a beautiful woman.
Sure.
I have a fantastic, you know, something, some experience. So there's no way of predicting what is going to change your life.
Right.
Because your life isn't about where it's going. It's about where it is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, the woman with the lesions, you know, and people can only sort of look at it. I'm getting excited now. People can only look at it in terms of Jesus. You know, a lot of people can find their solace in an outside belief system. But I believe that we are all the sons and daughters of God, and our higher consciousness unified is what God is. You know, I don't see God as being separate from who we are.
Right.
We are part of that. And I think if you do feel that unity with everyone else, there's a complete, you know, your ego just disappears.
I love that. I love that, Michael, that you started that thought by saying, "Dig this," because no, with your accent, you can say "dig this." If I say "dig this," someone punches me right in the face. But I love
and that someone is me.
Yes.
Oh, I've been punched in the face, but they never got up after I punched them from the streets of London. I'm making a movie right now with Gina Gershon, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and
Gina Gershon.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
Oh my God.
And there was some guy there that was nervous, I guess, and we were talking about music or something, and he went, "Oh, fuck you, Michael, listen to this." But what did you say? And all of that can come up.
Yeah.
You know, I could
bring the villain out in you.
Well, I would tear his larynx out and shove it up his ass, you know, in the old days, you know. And that violence in me is still in me because I am from the streets of London, you know, and that was a very volatile place to be, and I really try to work at my temper, you know, especially when you're fatigued, when you work in this artistic profession, you know, it's a lot of hanging around waiting to do the thing, and that can cause a lot of pressure. And one of the ways I've discovered of sustaining a great performance is you must be able to be aware of tempo and timing and conserve. And so when you're ready and that beautiful room is now lit after you've waited six fucking hours since you rehearsed the scene, and you must be ready to go in there and be glorious, you know, and things like that can distract you, you know, like this guy, well, fuck, you know, he's trying to impress me or somebody else, and I have to learn to breathe deeply.
He's kind of being douchey.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
And then I just put my bodyguard on him and
unleash the tiger.
Exactly.
The white
That's
tiger.
A very evolved approach to taking I think Michael's trying to tell us it's time to wrap it up with this tempo and time.
Okay.
Is that what's going on here?
Michael, do you want to play, would you mind playing another song for us?
Sure. This is a song I wrote about, which is also an extremely important thing, and that is forgiveness. Oh, yeah, yeah. All right. If ever you love me, baby, like you said you did, begging you, baby, won't you please forgive? 'Cause I am
loved you all along. I was stupid, baby. I was young. I have needed you all these years. Oh, yeah, now. All I ever gave you was tears. Come on, baby. Forgive me, baby. Forgive me, baby. Forgive me, baby. And take me back. Forgive me. Forgive me. Forgive me, baby.
That is also a song off of Carnaby Street. Nice. I love Carnaby Street. 10 songs, that's the old school way to do it. 10. That's perfect.
Any more than that, it's like you it's like staying at somebody's house as a guest one night too long. And eating all the food and doing all the drugs. No, you get in and you get out, man, you know.
So this is Carnaby Street. It's called the Michael DeBar Band.
That's it.
So it's not you, Sil. You put a band together. You guys are more studio stuff down the road, hopefully.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm putting out so many things. I have this song Rock and Roll Santa out for Christmas.
Oh, yes. Tell us about that.
Which I'd love you to sample or play a little bit of. It's on iTunes, Amazon, and CD Baby. And it's interesting. I love Christmas, but I wrote this song about, Santa losing weight so he could get down the chimney.
Nice.
And people have really responded. Steve Van Zandt plays it on Sirius, you know, as do the Christmas Channel on Sirius. And it's really penetrated. And please listen to it because it's about, you know, eating good and maybe chilling with the cookies and eating a fruit plate. Check it out.
That'll be our play out. How about that?
Okay, we'll play out with that.
Do you have it? Because I have it if you want me to give it
to
you.
Yeah, give it to me.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, do you have some dates that people should be aware of if they're...
I'm going to do a show in New York on January the 25th. Mm-hmm. For my East Coast friends, I'm going to do a benefit for Sandy the Storm because so many of my fellow musicians lost a lot of their stuff. And I'm going to do it with a group called Rockers in Recovery, which is an organization clearly of rock and roll musicians who quit drugs and alcohol.
Awesome.
Ricky Bird is the musical director of that. And we're going to do, Gina's going to sing with us. And
she's got a great voice, yeah.
Incredible musician, a great singer, and plays the Mean Jews harps.
Nice.
You know? Yeah, and a lot of other wonderful people. Billy J. Kramer.
Oh, wow.
It's going to do the show.
Dakotas. Yeah.
So it's going to be very, very interesting. And that is at the Cutting Room in January. And then the Michael DeBar Band at the end of January, beginning of February, will go out on a tour supporting both Carnaby Street, the album that you can get on iTunes, Amazon, Gonzo Multimedia, and also the live album, which is called Hot and Sticky, live from Carnaby Street, which comes out at the end of January. So we'll be hopefully coming to your hometown.
Can they find those dates on – do you have a website?
Oh, my God. Do I have – yes. I have www.debarr.com, DESBARRES.com, and I also have another website, MDBEmedia, IMMEDIA. You can find me on Twitter and
Facebook
Instagram and Facebook and every other social network. And you can knock on my door and I'll let you in.
This has been a blast.
This has been great, Michael. I mean, I think it's just the tip of the iceberg, what we could talk to with Michael DeBar. But
I didn't even get into MacGyver that much.
I know. We need to do an all MacGyver episode. But I contacted Michael and he was gracious enough to immediately contact me back. And here he is. And we thank you. And let's play this out.
Classy guy, talented guy.
Well, wait a minute.
Intimidating.
Wait. I would say that I've enjoyed this tremendously.
Oh, thank you.
And
it's a
lovely way to spend my Sunday morning.
Oh,
and I wish you and your listeners all that you wish yourselves. God bless you. Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Santa got skinny this Christmas time. Chimney is gonna be fine. Last year was tough. All those cookies and stuff. Put out.